Good afternoon. I'm very pleased and honored to introduce today's speaker, the Honorable Jamie Horsley. Am I coming out all right in this thing? Who will speak to us today about the people of China. We read and hear a lot about the political leaders of China and its military and its economic expansion into many parts of the world. But we don't often read or hear about the people of China, the fabric of the society, how problems are being handled, and with what results. We will hear more about that today from someone who has devoted her entire professional life to these kinds of considerations. Jamie Horsley got her undergraduate degree at Stanford University, a master's in Chinese studies at the University of Michigan, her JD from the Harvard Law School, and finally a diploma in Chinese law from the University of East Asia in Macau. And then she went to work. She became a partner in a prestigious New York law firm specializing in Chinese affairs, and then served as commercial attaché in United States embassies in Beijing and Manila, then became vice president of Motorola International, and then director of government relations for China for Motorola. And she later served as a consultant to the Carter Center on village elections in China. Then came her 16-year stint at Yale University, where she became and still is a senior fellow at the Paul Tsai China Center and is a lecturer at the law school. And she very recently became a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington. Now, I could go on, believe it or not, but I will end on one note. And it has to do with what I call the Naples interlude. Somewhere in the midst of all this, Jamie, her husband, who was a retired Foreign Service officer, and her two sons moved to Naples. Where her sons attended middle school and some high school before they all moved north again to New Haven, Connecticut to join Yale. In Naples, Jamie became a highly valued member of the Naples Council on World Affairs. And she was a member of the Great Decisions Discussion Group. And so, ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to present to you one of our very own, Jamie Horsley.
Well, hello, Naples. So it's great to be back here again. When I lived here with my family, we had actually moved back from China at the insistence of our two boys, who were born overseas, both in Hong Kong, and would only see the United States during the summer, you know, but they enjoyed everything, and they were so struck. We came and stayed in Naples one summer, and they saw the July 4th parade, and both wanted to become Cub Scouts, so they could be in the parade, too. And we found a house and eventually moved back, and I took a sort of career break, but managed to fill it during the 4 years that we were here, by working with the Carter Center as sort of a consultant on their village election program. So it got me back to China in a totally different capacity than I'd had before, and actually laid the groundwork for the eventual move the wrong direction up north to Yale University. We now live in Washington, D.C., which is why I have this nice post at the Brookings Institute, which has a wonderful China Center and great colleagues there. But I'm still working with the Yale Paul Tsai at China, it used to be the China Law Center, on various projects in China. My interest in the topic, of course, dates way back. First time I went to China was to Taiwan. I was a language student there back in the early 70s and lived in a Chinese family that had moved over, you know, during World War II to Taipei. And because of my work and various years living in China, which was a total of about 13 years, including Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Beijing, that I've come to have a great admiration for the Chinese people. And I was thrilled when I was asked to speak on this topic. You know, you're getting a lot of other people in your readings and great decisions about U.S.-China relations and foreign policy, military, national security issues. These are really important, and we can talk about them later in the Q&A if you wish. But I think what gives me hope and keeps me going constantly is what I know about the dynamism, the warm-heartedness, the hardworking Chinese people, because they are China's future, not the leaders who come and go and different cycles of governance and economics in China, but the Chinese people. So here we are, 2018. This, as you may have already been told, is the 40th year of China's fantastic reform and opening up program. It was launched by Deng Xiaoping at the end of 1978, just as China was coming out of a chaotic and destructive decade called the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution, which was the second major upheaval that had been launched by Mao Zedong, who had died by that point. And Deng Xiaoping put in place new policies by working to persuade all his comrades to try and introduce some market-oriented principles to revive the Chinese economy, and for the first time since the founding of the People's Republic of China, to open its doors to foreign investment. China had had some trade, mostly within the communist bloc before, and, you know, in the decade before opening up, it had expanded it with Japan and a few other countries that had recognized China. But we didn't have, remember, diplomatic relations with China until 1979. And we were a major part of their opening and reform project. Happily, I had just graduated from law school in 1978. And by then, I spoke Chinese. I had spent time in Taiwan and done my graduate work and all that, and had hoped somehow to be able to get involved with China. And by 1981, I had joined the law firm of Paul Weiss in New York because they were opening an office in Beijing, had a major oil company client, and wanted to serve their companies on the ground to start investing in China. It was a great adventure. 1981. At this time, again, China had just started opening up. It was still a very poor country. The Chinese people still had to use ration coupons to use for their rice, their noodles, their cloth, etc. And they were still going around in these, you know, blue and green Mao suits. Everybody was riding bicycles. It was still a very poor country. And foreigners were looked at with a great deal of suspicion, but also interest. And that's when I discovered the inscrutable Chinese were not inscrutable at all. All you had to do was smile, and, you know, immediately could make a connection. So you fast forward to 2018. So this is a momentous year, too. By now, China has accomplished a lot. They've lifted 800 million of their people out of poverty, which is an amazing feat. They're now the second largest economy in the world, the first largest if you use this PPP parity model, which the World Bank occasionally uses, but I think they're the second largest. And some people think they may soon overtake the United States. Internally, the current leader, Xi Jinping, has set a goal for eliminating poverty altogether and achieving what they call a moderately prosperous society by 2020. That's just 2 years from now. It's a very laudable goal, and they're working hard to achieve that. At the recently concluded Communist Party meeting last fall, when Xi Jinping was reelected as head of the Communist Party, the General Secretary, he announced that China has stood up, grown rich, and become strong. Yet that's not quite right. China's GDP per capita is below the world average still. If you use this purchasing power parity figure, it's at about $16,000. Otherwise, it's only half at $8,200. So they are still not really a rich country. They still have over 30 million people living below the poverty line as China defines it, which is about 95 cents a day. This is why Xi Jinping is so committed to trying to finish lifting those people out. Just last year in 2017, they claim to have gotten another 17 million out of that. So it's now down to 30.5 million, with the goal this year of bringing another 17 million out of poverty. And he's getting everybody in society together to help achieve this goal. Each work unit, whether it's a government office or a company, is assigned a village or a place in China that they're supposed to mentor. People are supposed to go down, get to know the people, help them raise money, just help them get along. It's quite an amazing effort. But in addition to the poverty, China, of course, through its rapid growth, has an awful lot of domestic challenges. Environmental degradation, which is really quite horrific, in both the air, the soil, and water. And they are working on that one very hard. And then they have a number of economic and other social challenges we'll talk about. Interestingly, 2018 is also something called a Wu Xu year. A Chinese friend wrote me at Chinese New Year and said, you know, this Wu Xu year comes around every 60 years on one of those other Chinese traditional calendars that has that cycle. And he said, Wu Xu years are times of great change in China and often sort of cataclysmic. 1898 saw a failed or an aborted 100-day reform program launched by then a young emperor named Guangxu that ended with a coup d'etat by the Empress Dowager Cixi and ended the reform movement, although the Qing dynasty soon fell. The next Wuxi year was 1958, and that was the year that Mao Zedong launched the Great Leap Forward in an attempt to rapidly modernize China through collectivization and industrialization, and resulted in an estimated upwards of 30 to 55 million deaths by the time it ended in 1962. So here we are in 2018, another Wuxi year, so we'll see what we have coming. While today in the U.S. we face our own issues, of course, in China they have a lot going on. We see a rising China that is increasingly assertive in security matters abroad and around the world. We accuse them of employing mercantilist and unfair trade policies abroad that give them an advantage. And moreover, China more recently has been perceived as exporting a sort of pernicious political and ideological model, and in some cases also trying to export repressive tactics they use at home. There have been reports in Europe, for example, of notifying young people who are studying there from the Xinjiang region, which is Muslim, putting pressure through their families to have them come back because they're very worried about the terrorist problem that Xinjiang has become associated with. But this using of families to pressure people, and then often these young people go home and are put in jail because they're suspected of having learned terrorist inclinations from their studies abroad. Indeed, it's gotten so bad that in February, the FBI Director Wray, in testifying before the Senate Intelligence Committee, announced that the problem from China represents a whole-of-society threat to our military, economic, security, ideological, cultural, informational setup across the globe. And it's coming from what they call non-traditional collectors, including, and he specified, Chinese students, scholars, and scientists. And he said this problem needs a whole of American society response. So a lot of us working on U.S.-China relations in China, we're horrified that with one brush he's tarred all of the Chinese people, basically. So we're hoping to have a much more nuanced discussion about, you know, what are issues we should be worried about, what are threats, what are reasonable ways to deal with them while maintaining a cooperative and productive relationship with China. But meanwhile, foreign policy experts are arguing, where did we get China wrong? We should never have let them into the WTO, et cetera, et cetera. I won't go into all the details, but you've read about how President Trump has already imposed some tariffs and is threatening to impose a lot more now because of China misbehavior, even though many people argue these are not the best weapons used to address those problems. So in any event, we've now seen what may be the worst deterioration in U.S.-Chinese relations in almost 30 years, and since I've certainly been working on the U.S.-China relationship. So 2018 is turning out to be quite a year and a critical year for China, I think. You also may have been reading about the meeting going on in China right now, which is another momentous occasion. So the party has its big national congress in the fall, where it elects party leaders and sets policy. And then 6 months later, every March, the state counterpart, the People's Congress, National People's Congress, has a meeting where it then elects state leaders, passes state laws, et cetera, et cetera. And it's always been basically according to the playbook given to them by the Communist Party coming out of that. And this year was no different. But this has been a very momentous meeting because during it, Xi Jinping promoted a revision of their state constitution, which very unexpectedly did away with the two-term limit, which Deng Xiaoping had instituted in the 1982 constitution to prevent a return to the one-man rule like Mao Zedong's, which had created such catastrophic occasions as the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution. Moreover, the Congress now has approved establishing a new branch of government, which will be a supersized anti-corruption agency, but under the auspices of a party institution in which it will essentially be embedded. And this anti-corruption institution will not only supervise or investigate misbehavior and sort of duty crimes, they call it, of civil servants, so in a way it's sort of like our inspectors general in the United States, but it will also supervise party members and anybody who is deemed to hold a position exercising public power. This would include public school teachers. This would include officials down in the village level, villager committees, et cetera. So they are going to expand the scope of their anti-corruption targeting by 2 to 3 times, depending on who you read, and make this be an entity that will also have the authority to supervise the courts, the state council itself, and even the National People's Congress to which it nominally will report. So this new agency is creating a lot of concern among the legal community on a variety of levels, including that during the course you're being investigated by this agency, you have no right to access a lawyer. And if you feel you've been mistreated unfairly, you have no right to sue the agency or any of its personnel. It's an unaccountable agency. So a lot's going on now in China, and this is just the latest evidence of the great leader Xi Jinping amassing further power to himself personally and to the party at the expense of the state. So meanwhile, while he's doing this, he still has to tackle enormous challenges at home, and he has to try and ensure a favorable international environment so that China can pursue a peaceful development and reach its goals. And it's in this climate that I think the topic of Chinese society and China's internal affairs could not be more important. Indeed, Xi's major message now is that rather than focus just on economic development, our main goal as the Communist Party must be to fulfill the Chinese people's aspirations for a better life, which he defines to include such things as democracy, justice, as well as a material better life as well. And he sees this as being important to achieve in order to establish the legitimacy for the party to continue its rule at home. But this emphasis on the people is an important message that he's brought forth. And I think it's sincere. The party has always known they need the support of the people to stay in power. No manner of coercive methods can manage to control 1.4 billion people, especially a society which is now much more educated, connected, networked, sophisticated, and used to having more and more of a say in events. So the challenges and the changes that Chinese society are facing have never been greater. But I always like to say that I think the changes in Chinese society since 1978 have been every bit as miraculous as has the economic performance we've witnessed from China. So let's do a little snapshot of Chinese society. So almost 1.4 billion people. The thing is, it's not necessarily still growing. They've got a rapidly aging population, largely due to this very unfortunate one-child policy that they pursued since 1979. And we'll talk more about that in a minute. Roughly 92% of the Chinese people are Han Chinese, that speak the Mandarin Chinese. But they do have about 56 recognized ethnic minorities, and some of them are in special autonomous regions. And you've probably heard of Tibet is one. Xinjiang region is another. And the Xinjiang region, it has the Uyghur people who are Muslim. In fact, they often look very Western. And one problem is that a lot of them are in touch with groups outside of China, including some terrorist groups. So there have been some terrorist incidents in China, blowing up buses, knifings in train stations, etc., that have been attributed to these Xinjiang terrorist groups. And so Xinjiang, and also Tibet, but particularly Xinjiang, has more recently become essentially kind of a police state. So that's a source of potential unrest and insecurity there. But of this 1.4 million, China has now shifted from being a predominantly rural country back in 1978 to about 60% living in urban areas. They've had a conscious urbanization program because they felt it was more efficient to be able to deliver services and take care of people in an urban environment than in the rural one. They've got over 772 million internet users. They call themselves netizens, very networked in China. And even more important than the internet now, which is subject to what they call the Great Firewall. So very hard to get on the internet and access outside of China. So it's more like an intranet. But the Chinese people also use social media. So Twitter and Facebook are prohibited in China, but they have Chinese equivalents. And over 900 million people daily use WeChat, which is the largest social media network in China today. And they use that not only to interact with their friends and family, but to purchase goods, transfer money, buy plane tickets, etc. It's quite astounding. And even this electronic payment technology that everyone is using through social media is soon to be overtaken by facial recognition. You may have read about how that's being used in China for surveillance purposes. It's a great anti-crime device. The police can use it now to try and follow and identify potential people they think are suspected criminals and target them very quickly. But they're rolling it out for just everyday uses. So when you go to get a train ticket now, they will scan your face, and then if you're trying to buy something, automatically access your account, transfer the money, etc. You don't even need to take anything out. I mean, China has skipped from basically a cash society. They never really used checkbooks. They've never really used credit cards. They went right from cash to their smartphone payment systems, and now even those are going to be outdated in, I'm told, 6 months. It's quite astounding. Also among all these people, you still have about 270 million migrant workers, people who come from the rural countryside and go to the cities to find seasonal work in factories, etc., or other kinds of things. Now, of that number, roughly 150 million migrants have now settled rather permanently in some of these areas. So it's a new social challenge of how to start integrating them into the urban areas. And we can talk about that a little more later, too. You've got, as I mentioned, an aging, eldering problem. You've got 230 million people over 60 as of the end of last year, and that percentage is going to go about 20% of the population will be over 60 by about 2030. So it's coming up quickly. Now, Chinese are also traveling in droves. This is a huge change from when I lived in China. In 1981, when I moved to China, I could only get a visa for one city. So I had a visa, not just to China, but to Beijing in particular. If I wanted to go to Tianjin next door, I had to apply to the public security people to get a visa to go there. There were similar restrictions on travel within China for Chinese as well. But now those have been lifted, and moreover, it's very easy for Chinese people to travel abroad. So 135 million Chinese are traveling abroad now, and you've probably seen a lot of them around. They stay in Airbnb around the world, and they spend, you know, $260 billion a year. So a lot of Chinese tourists. There are also a lot of Chinese students going abroad, too. You know, we've got about 350,000 Chinese students in the U.S. now, and this is almost five times what it was 10 years ago. And they're not just in universities and grad schools. More and more Chinese are coming to high school so they can build up their English, get better educated within the context of our system so that they can then go on to college. So this is a wonderful opportunity for us, and I hate to see the students suddenly being targeted as all being potential spies. They're a wonderful resource for us, for those who stay and become American citizens. But many of them now are going back to China because with the expanding economy, they felt they had more job opportunities back there. And in fact, China is actively recruiting them to come back and take part in their so-called new economy they're developing. Also of interest is China's got over 100 million Protestants and about 12 million Catholics. This means there are more Christians in China than there are Communist Party members. The party now stands at about 90 million. Also of interest is we have about 70 million estimated gay people in China, identified as LGBTQI. And as Chinese people become, you know, wealthier and more sophisticated, their social tolerance has risen as well. And so while the gay population still doesn't have recognized legal rights against anti-discrimination, etc., socially, there's a great deal of tolerance. And some have even applied to try and force the issue of gay marriage forward. Taiwan, which they call the renegade province across the straits, has legalized gay marriage there. It's still working its way through the system. And many people in China are beginning to work on that, too. They even have a transgender population, which has started filing anti-discrimination lawsuits, which the courts are hearing. It's an incredibly diverse and dynamic social situation over there. But as I said, the poverty issue still persists as well, and we have other social problems in addition. So a lot of these are tied up with the one-child policy that I talked about earlier. The one-child policy was put in place, as I said, in 1979, and it was intended to address the fear of too many people in China, which has very, very little arable land. And given the preference for boys in Chinese traditional culture over girls, this led to infanticide, or as we're discovering now, a lot of unreported first births of girls, that these girls might be hidden so that they could go and try again for a boy. So they have an incredible gender imbalance that is built up now. They used to say that by 2020, China would have 30 million more men than women. They've already passed that. There are 34 million more men in China than women. And you can just think of the social problems this might create. Of people. So some traditional crimes of wife napping have resurged. They even have been kidnapping some women from across the border, bringing them in. Most of these men who are unable to find wives are in the rural, poorer areas, of course. A lot of the young people leave the villages and go to the cities now, just like you would anywhere. And the young women who have this demographic advantage now clearly want to get partners who make a lot more money and can offer them an apartment and the benefits of urban life. So this gender imbalance is a real problem. And it actually ties into this eldering problem, the age imbalance. Because they only had one child, you've now got the most rapidly aging society in the world. And as they always say in China, China is growing old before it became rich. They have a very, very preliminary pension system, very, very underfunded. They're really behind the curve in developing elder care facilities, etc. With the urbanization and the one-child families, the whole social structure has changed a lot when you add in particularly mobility. So it used to be generations of a family would live together, and the grandparents would take care of the kids, and then in their old age, the kids would take care of the grandparents. So that has changed, much more like an American situation now. Still happens sometimes, but a lot of older people are left on their own. And China doesn't have sufficient elder care institutions for them yet, even though they have a very widespread basic health insurance now, which they estimate covers like 1.3 billion people. But it is very basic. It doesn't cover a lot of things. In addition to those imbalances, we have a huge wealth imbalance now, wealth inequality. It's not quite as bad as here, but it's pretty bad. Basically, the top 1% households in China own about a third of the country's wealth, whereas the bottom 25% get only 1% of the country's wealth. So there's a huge wealth. China has a lot of billionaires, if you look at the global reports. And I was going to say it later, but I think 6 out of 10 of the self-made women billionaires are Chinese also. Given all these problems, too, they still have educational challenge, although China claims to have over 95% literacy rate, which is defined as being able to read and write by the age of 15. Nonetheless, in the rural areas, a lot of the schools are underfunded. They may have a building, but insufficient books. It's very hard to recruit teachers to go out and spend time in the village areas. And as the number of children have gone down, increasingly, they're trying to get them to travel farther to all go to one school, say, in the county seat. And so a lot of kids are being asked to go to boarding school in order just to access primary education, and many families cannot even afford that. At the higher range, they realize that their university education system may need to be retooled. That's why a lot of students want to come study here, in the United States or in England or Australia or other countries, Europe, for a university education, because they think it will give them better skills to deal with a rapidly changing society around them. China still struggles with health problems. They have many chronic diseases that impact the population. I was struck, even though they've had a big anti-smoking campaign, they still estimate that about 27% of the Chinese population smokes, and one out of every three smokers in the world is Chinese. And China's also the biggest producer as well as consumer of tobacco. So this contributes to a high rate of lung cancer and emphysema, other issues. They have stroke, heart disease, diabetes, as well as other issues that are increasing as they get wealthier, such as obesity and stress as well, like us. So this is a society that is dealing with multiple problems in many different levels, and they always like to call this they're grappling with left-behind children, who are the children left in the countryside when both parents go to the city to make more money. And because they're left with the grandparents who are often out in the fields working or carrying down another job, they tend to be unattended. And so, particularly in the first years of their life, it's very important they get a lot of attention. And China's just begun to focus on the impact this is having on their mental capacities. So you have left behind children. There have been some horrible stories about children freezing to death or, you know, running off. Then you have leftover women who are the single women who now don't really want to get married and want to pursue their careers instead. And so they're calling them leftover women. And then what I call the left out men, these 34 million men who can't find a spouse. It's a very complicated situation. So anyway, as China's growing middle class is becoming getting more and more of a voice, but they aren't demanding democracy. What they're really focused on is maintaining the status quo that has allowed them to better their lives and social stability. But they are asking for things like clean air and water, safe food and drugs, safe work conditions. China still has a big issue with work safety. Their good education, job prospects. As China's improved their basic university education, they have so many people graduating now, the state can't guarantee jobs for everyone anymore, which might sound familiar here. And then everybody, of course, is demanding affordable health care and increasingly elder care. So if we want to drill down into some aspects of this society, on the eldering issue, due to the one-child policy, you know, a rapidly aging population, what this has a big implication for China's economic prospects going forward. It's a huge demographic problem. For example, China is rapidly going from a situation where they have basically five workers supporting each retiree in 2016 to a situation where by 2040 they'll only have 1.6 workers supporting each retiree. And they don't have an open immigration policy like we do or had in the United States. And so this is a perennial problem that is only going to get worse. They now have more people exiting the workforce than entering it. And we've seen already some areas of China that used to be the factories that turned out, you know, tennis shoes and textiles and stuff. They can't recruit workers to come in, and not at the wages they're willing to pay. So a lot of that low-end manufacturing and light industry is moving out of China to India, Vietnam, and other low-wage places. And there's been a lot of pressure on the upward wage as well. As I mentioned, their pension system's inadequate, and they're really going to have to start spending a lot of money on taking care of the elderly population, which is mostly poor at this point. They haven't been saving for this time, and the Chinese state is going to have a huge issue. Some people talk about this as being faced with, rather than a guns versus butter question, it's a guns versus canes debate, how to take care of all their elderly people. In contrast to the eldering part, the youth of China, again, I think, are just amazing. Chinese millennials are more like millennials here in the U.S. and around the world than they are with their parents and certainly with Comrade Xi Jinping and his folks. When I watch them in their very stylized presentations and the way they talk and the things they talk about, they seem so far removed from what we hear and see walking down the streets in China every day, which is just very dynamic, very lively, et cetera. I mean, I'm sure what reason Xi Jinping is trying to get power and trying to assert the primacy and importance of the Communist Party to China is precisely because he fears that it has become increasingly irrelevant to most people in China. There's about 400 million millennials in China now, and you could say there's almost like a culture war going on recently with China's attempt to, you know, make people toe the line and behave themselves better. They've taken to banning tattoos, depictions of tattoos in broadcasts, hip-hop. There's huge hip-hop clubs in China, and I wanted to bring a PowerPoint this time and show you pictures of, you know, the kids with the spiky hair and the earrings and stuff in their nose, et cetera, the skateboarders, people, it looks like you would just be in the United States as well. There's just a lot of fervor, a lot of, as I say, dynamism going on. They also are very tech savvy. I mean, it really amazes me. They've grown up with high-speed trains that you would not believe. I mean, the fact that we don't have a high-speed train from even Washington, D.C. to New York, let alone Boston, is something the Chinese just scratch their head. You know, it just takes a couple hours to get from Beijing to Shanghai now. And, in fact, most people prefer to take the high-speed trains than to fly in China as well. They've grown up with the smartphones, with this rapidly developing technology. When I visited China in the fall of 2016, I was talking with a legal scholar, you know, what are the hot issues in China these days? And he said one was how to regulate the sharing economy. I didn't even know what the sharing economy was. But, of course, this is the Ubers, the Airbnbs, et cetera, what some people call the platform economy, where all kinds of people provide something over the platform and users can then take part in it. Well, at that time, China was learning from the U.S. because we invented the sharing economy. But by now, just not even 2 years later, China is the largest sharing economy in the world, and they've started exporting their innovations around the world. And one of the big ones is dockless bikes. This was amazing. You know, as I said, in 1981, when I first moved to China, millions of bikes on the road, very few cars, one taxi company, and people took buses, but most of them drove bikes. I did too as well. It was great. And then over time, as the cars, you know, built up, bikes became less and less visible, and you saw fewer and fewer of them. Well, the sharing economy has totally turned it around again. You know, part of it, people are becoming more environmentally conscious, but the other is they're beginning to realize bikes can help them solve what they call the last mile, first mile problem. People can bike to the nearest metro station, leave the bike off, come back and pick it up and go back. And the dockless model allows you to leave your bike anywhere. It's locked by a GPS thing, and so you can come out and just find a bike somewhere, use your phone to pay for it, boom, and off you go, and then leave it at your home when you get there. This device, of course, started creating a lot of confusion because many companies started piling in, so you'd have each bike company had a different color bike, yellow, orange, bright green, blue, etc. And it got to be there were so many bikes being piled up everywhere, blocking alleyways, blocking streets, that the cities had to step in and kind of control it. But now in Washington, D.C., we have two of those bike companies, Ofo and Mobike, and they're competing with Capital Bike Share. And I'm seeing they're popping up in other U.S. cities, as well as they're now in Europe and in other parts of Asia as well. So what these young people are growing up with this very fastly evolving technology, and as I mentioned, facial recognition, for better or worse, will be on us very, very soon. I just wanted to mention they're also very quick to get on to various movements around the world, and I'll mention two of them. After Xi Jinping announced he was removing the term limits, overseas Chinese students started a movement. They posted posters of Xi Jinping with an X across him saying, "Not my president." And the hashtags were "Not my president" and "I don't agree." And these have spread all over college campuses around the world now. The Me Too movement. I'm not going to have time right now to get into the talk about women and women's status in China, which is complex. On the one hand, they finally adopted an anti-domestic violence law because one in four women in China suffer some form of domestic abuse. But they don't have laws against sexual harassment yet. So when the Me Too movement took off, you know, around the world they found other cities responding, China as well. But when it got to China, the first reported case was a former student accused one of her professors at a prestigious Peking university of having sexually harassed her, at which point several other students spoke up and reported they'd had the same experience. The person was fired. People started trying to do that at other universities. They started getting shut down by the censors. Chinese Ministry of Education promised they were going to put in place policies. It has not spread yet to other workplaces, et cetera. But because of the censorship that came out against the Me Too hashtag, just an example, the Chinese then develop using characters that sound like Me Too but have a different meaning to try and get around the censors. And so the most popular one was characters Me Too that mean rice bunny. And so that became a joke, the rice bunny, to get around it. And they do this all the time. Very humorous, very funny, very quick, and very bright. And I'll just end with it, too, that they're also a very giving. Some people describe them as the want generation, but they're also the giving generation. They're using these online crowdsourcing funds, for example, to do worthy causes. They're volunteering. China's got 50 million registered volunteers, which means they're volunteering for fairly, you know, state-supported type stuff. But there's an outpouring of volunteerism, of organizing informal NGOs. China did pass a charity law. Even though they're cracking down on foreign NGOs and they're suspicious of these unregistered ones and social activity generally, they realize the help that society through these associations can give the government in elder care and trying to monitor polluting factories and doing a whole variety of things. And the young people are into this. And one woman I know, for example, had visited the rural areas, realized these rural kids had the school but no books. So she started an NGO, which is not yet registered. She's trying to figure it out. But basically so that people would donate iPads and Kindles. And then they load books for the school curriculums onto these devices. Because apparently everybody in the villages has the Wi-Fi now, the internet. They just don't have the books. So I thought that was a wonderful idea and sort of epitomizes this kind of creativity and caring that you do see among the younger generation as well. So I think it's already now a little past 4:30. I should probably stop and take your questions, and I'm very interested to hear what you're interested in hearing about. Thank you.
Thank you. We have mics set up on the far side, and Ms. Horsley will take your questions now. Bob.
Yo. Hi.
Hi.
Thank you very much. Very, very interesting. I'm kind of curious. The Chinese are not without their demons. I'm thinking in terms of the common borders they have with India, with Russia, with Nepal to the north, and with North Korea. And, of course, the South China Sea, they have real issues as far as controlling that. How do they deal with those? Do you feel that that is a preoccupation, or they can roll with that fairly easily?
That's a great question. I think they're very worried about all of those issues, and they very much, you know, want to have good relations with their border neighbors, but they want to be able to deal with them one by one and try and settle things, of course, on terms that are favorable to them. You know, they still have border issues with India, as I'm sure you're aware, and they've had flare-ups over that recently. In the South China Seas, there are a lot of conflicting claims to these islands. China's preference is just like Trump's. You know, he wants to do one-on-one negotiations so they don't have to face a collective of interests. So those, they're trying one by one and often using economic inducements as well as economic threats to try and bring, you know, some of their neighbors or other contestants around to their way of seeing things. I think they realize they've sort of blown it with their Southeast Asia neighbors, too, by being a little too much of a bully. They seem to pull back a bit now and realize that they need to, for example, they're all talking about negotiating a code of conduct and things in the area as well, which would be great. Another one would be to work out natural resources sharing and also environmental issues and overfishing, et cetera, et cetera. With Russia, you know, they've had a tense relationship historically, because I think anybody who shares a border, you know, may have that. And while right now Putin and Xi are good comrades because they kind of need each other, it's still, I would say, not a really warm and fuzzy relationship. And a lot of us are wondering what Putin and Russia thinks about China's sort of Silk Road initiative, you know, which they now call Belt and Road, where they're helping build infrastructure and build railways and highways connecting China with all these countries across Eurasia, South Asia, over to Europe as well. And a lot of those, you know, are border and are in, you know, Russia's traditional area, all the stans, et cetera, which have very wealthy in natural resources, et cetera. So that's still a potential hot point that needs to be managed. And then North Korea, you know, they called it the Hermit Kingdom. And the reason why historically Korea has had Russia, China, and Japan kind of surrounding it, and they're very insistent on wanting to be independent. So North Korea, while it's been dependent economically on China, it wants to be independent of them politically. And I think part of their desire to have the atom bomb is not just because of the U.S., but also to give them more negotiating leverage with China as well to stay away, and Japan and the other countries around them. Everybody thinks China has a lot of leverage against North Korea because they do provide so much economic support and oil, et cetera. But China feels they're limited in doing that. They have gone along more recently with the sanctions, but they're afraid of pushing too far so that we don't have what happened to Japan on the eve of World War II when we did an oil embargo, and next thing we knew, we had Pearl Harbor. So, you know, they're right on the border from North Korea. And I've asked a few people, how many of North Korea's missiles are aimed at China? Because they've had tense relations. Xi Jinping has never met with Kim at all and doesn't like him and has let that be known. So right now, they have even more tense relationships than normal. And then Kim, of course, is very unhappy that China has gone along with some of these sanctions and seems to be working with the U.S. So the North Korea issue is one, you know, I don't follow closely, but I think, like everyone, we're all very nervous how it's going to turn out and hope that Trump can pull that off. It'd be great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next question comes over here, and then the next three questions over there.
With all these changes, is there any Marxism left in Chinese communism? And how would you define Chinese communism now?
Another great question. Xi Jinping himself is trying to reintroduce the Marxist-Leninist, now you've got to add Xi Jinping thought, studies and awareness into the Chinese consciousness. As I mentioned, I mean, as China has become more open, I mean, I didn't say this, although it's still dominated by a state sector that gets most of the state funding and support. In fact, you know, over 60% of the GDP comes from the private sector now. And over 90% of the new job creation comes out of private companies. So there has been a lot of private activity and sort of market activity naturally, not only along the coast, the richer coast, but also inland, because most of the service industry that's coming up is private as well. And so one wonders, what is the relevance of Marxist-Leninism in China today? It's very relevant to the party and its legitimacy, and they're trying to reassert this, to rewrite university curriculums, to require Marxism-Leninism study and Xi Jinping thought. They're establishing new centers. They're making all the party members memorize the things that, like they used to do back in the 80s when I lived there. So they're trying to make it relevant to the current time. And Xi himself sees as a great heir to sort of Maoist take on Marxism-Leninism as well. I think a lot of us have our doubts whether this is really going to take hold in China. They've just come so far already, but I think that's what he's trying to do is reassert its relevance.
Next question, please.
Could you share your impressions of the Chinese ability to innovate versus their need to copy?
Another great question, too, and that seems to be another myth that is being blown out of the room these days. We've long thought, because of the Chinese education system, which focuses more on the memorization of things and restricts your ability to express yourself and et cetera, that this would inhibit China's ability to innovate. But in fact, particularly in the private sector, we're seeing a lot of innovation going on in all kinds of areas, including health. I mean, you know, China may be the one to solve the cancer issue. You know, there's just very interesting things going on. And increasingly, the state is recognizing this and is beginning to offer to help seed or fund some of these startups and setting up technology innovation incubators to encourage, you know, young people to come in with ideas and work them through. And the question is, you know, at what point does the state feel then they have to step in and try and take control of whatever the result of it was? I think there's still a tension in China, but the Chinese people themselves have shown total ability to innovate, and we've certainly seen that from the Chinese come to the U.S., and once they're in U.S. labs and classrooms, they have no problems. And I think even in China's more restrictive environment, we're seeing a lot of very surprising and important innovation going on. And not just in technology, but in business practices like the sharing economy, the way they've been developing the whole use of smartphones, they're light years ahead of us with this digital payment system. So many, many areas. We're getting a lot out of China these days.
Next question, yeah. Please.
Thank you for an interesting discussion. Last year, I met a group of Chinese tourists in Greece, and in discussions I had with them, they said they like visiting Greece because of its history and culture, which was comparable to that of China. My question is, to what extent Chinese history and culture impacts today's society?
I'm not sure to what extent their traditional culture and history impacts the society today. It's true that they've grown up in a society that is still much influenced by Confucian traditions, which include, you know, a hierarchy, you know, listening to your superiors, women to men, which is part of the preference for boys too, et cetera. They're very proud of their long history and all the inventions that the Chinese made over the years. They're very proud of their culture, the art and the, you know, poetry and everything that were. So I think that's part of what makes them feel proud to be Chinese as a Chinese nation, a big sense of that. But in terms of day-to-day relations and, you know, the political system, I'm more a believer in it's a matter of policies, you know, than culture per se that determine those things. But I do think the Chinese have a very strong self-identity with their, as they like to say, 5,000 years of history, which really is quite extraordinary. And I can't really say much more than that, but and not being Chinese myself, so I don't know. But that's what I see, that's what I observe. And I'm not sure how much of modern history they actually are taught too, but certainly the sweep of, you know, imperial history, some of the good things that came down from that, they still learn. And they have a lot of historical dramas on TV and that sort of thing that instill the pride.
Thank you, James.